This is Comics Coast to Coast.
Everybody, this is Brian Dunaway, and you're listening to Comics Coast to Coast, episode 226, the Dave Blazek interview. And we're going to be talking to Dave just in a minute about his wonderful comic Loose Parts. But before we do that, I have some loose parts. I have Joel Duggan of Starcrossed Online. Joel.
Trying not to laugh. Through the intro.
Must keep parts inside. You must act. Yeah, for those who don't know, Joel tried to cut his thumb off a few minutes ago before the show.
Yeah, I was making a lamp, and then...
Wait.
In Canada, the lamp makes you, apparently, or makes you bleed. So, yeah, I cut my thumb about an hour ago.
Right.
And I seem to be okay. I left most of my life force on the kitchen floor. But as of right now, I'm lucid.
Right.
And ready to go.
Oh, my God. I want to hear more about this later, but we're going to come back to that. Also, we have Matthew Ducharme back this week. Mostly back. He is... he's a little bit under the weather still. Matt.
Indeed. Yeah. I guess the theme here is injury or ill health.
Right. Look how dedicated this team is. They're incredible. And on to our very special guest this week, Dave Blazek of Loose Parts Comics. How are you, sir?
Hey, hi guys. How are you? Boy, I feel like I'm a new guy in prison and three guys have been cornered.
We've got some questions.
Who's the guy with the husky voice?
Right. All of them. We got questions for you, Mr. Comic Syndicated. Funny man.
Hey, you know, I have a question, though. Comics Coast to Coast, does that extend into territorial waters?
It does now. It started out for a little history about Comics Coast to Coast. If you didn't know, originally, Justin Thompson and I of Myth Tickle and Tom Racine of Tall Tale Radio, who we want to talk about in a few minutes because he interviewed you last year on episode 166 of Tall Tale Radio. Go back and listen to that after this. But no, stay here for right now. Originally, Comics Coast to Coast was because I was all the way on the East Coast in South Carolina, and Justin was all the way in California at the Santa Rosa Peanuts Shoals Studios, and so we were literally coast to coast. And since then, it's kind of went more vertical.
But it's good to know that I can still wade a good 20 miles out into the Atlantic.
Not a problem.
And still be included in the description.
You will still be within the legal parameters of the title right. Comics Coast to Coast. Absolutely.
Well, I'm all comfy in my bedroom here. I've got my Harpoon Winter warmer beer here. So this will get stranger the longer we go.
Hey, you know, I listened to Tall Tale Radio as well. And I noticed that you are a connoisseur of fine beers.
I am a connoisseur of fine beers. Are you as well?
I am not, but I have friends. I have friends who are, and they're always bringing me these fantastic beers, and they're saying, "Here, try this." And I'm like, "Yes, beer. Thanks, man. I appreciate it."
Leave more for the rest of us. That's fine.
He just went and bought. He bought some kind of really expensive beer at a really good deal, like about 2 weeks ago. That he was so psyched about because apparently if one of the bottles in a crate gets busted or something, then they have to take the other ones and put them into this mix pack or something. I don't know. I don't get all that stuff. So
you drink just like the powdered beer mix. You just put it in water and stir it around.
It's pretty
like a SodaStream thing.
Dehydrated beer.
Beer mix. Oh,
man. So what's your favorite beer, Dave? Because you said you're drinking. What you drinking right now?
This is a Harpoon Winter Lager from somewhere up New England way. I like many different beers. Pennsylvania is one of the stranger beer states in America. You can't just walk into a normal grocery store and buy beer. You have to go to a licensed beer expert place and buy it by the case. And so every time I go in, I buy something a little different, although I tend towards the maltier, heartier winter brews this time of the year. And henceforth, I'm trying this one. This is just like my third or fourth bottle. But at any given time, I have a beer fridge with a good 20 different beers in it. It's not just me. It's my wife.
I'm going to pass a little blame off right now.
I got to confirm this. Is Dave the first guest we've had who has admitted to drinking while he does the interview?
I think I don't know if Mark Tatulli admitted to it.
Oh, Tatulli had to be drinking.
But I'm pretty sure he was pretty drunk the first time. We interviewed him twice. And the first time he was definitely drunker. Well,
you know,
I know John Sanford drinks on the show.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah. You know, on my latest book, his blurb on the back is, what do I know? I'm drunk.
So, well, there you
that's
go.
That's awesome.
I mean, do you know that Mark and I actually go back. Mark and I knew each other
right.
before either of us were cartoonists. We were working in Philly, and you know, I have this other parallel career as an ad guy and stuff. I was making a TV commercial and went to a post-production facility, and Mark was a post-production video artist, and they wheeled me into this room and said, here's your, you know, your artist for the day, Mark, you know, he'll help you get all the graphics done and stuff. And I'm sitting there, you know, he's got all these doodles around. And I said, you know, what's all that? And he says, you know, I'm going to draw cartoons and so I want to be a, you know, syndicated cartoonist someday. And I'm thinking, this guy's nuts, you know? And
right.
So, and so as I always say, the amazing thing is that, you know, he did one of the great ones, but even more amazing, I did, which is just strange. So we still hang out together from time to time. I should tell you, when Stefan Pastis came to town and Mark and I took him out on town in Philadelphia, was a very interesting night, especially when Mark left to go to the bathroom and Stefan called Mark's wife or was texting her on the phone.
Oh my gosh, you never leave your phone with a bunch of pranksters.
Never leave your phone with Pastis. Just that's a cardinal rule of cartooning. They don't put that in the books. That should start off every cartoon instructional manual there is. Don't leave your phone with Stefan Pastis.
Never leave it with the Pastis. You know, Pastis was like our first real interview was with Stefan Pastis. He was instrumental in encouraging us to do our own podcast about comics because we weren't sure. We were like syndicated cartoonists talking to web cartoonists. Is that going to be something anyone's going to want to listen to? I don't know. And
you know, I you know, not to get too serious here.
Oh, please do.
I hope these things blend together. You know, I'm kind of involved in the NCS, National Cartoonist Society. As a matter of fact, we just started a chapter up in Philly that I'm somehow president of because they haven't found out yet. This has been a topic. And, you know, I can remember Mark standing up a few years ago saying, you know, what about the web guys? You know, let's get them going. So there's been a much more inclusionary kind of a thing about it. So I love what you guys do, man. I'm envy of the drawing chops and the storytelling and just the graphics. It's really cool stuff. I wish I was better. I wish I could do it.
No, you are in the right place for your talents. I mean, because the syndicated comics are, wow. I mean, they are, that is such a tough market to break into.
Yeah.
You know, web comics, that's fairly simple. You make your web comic, you post it. Now, if you actually want to make a living at it, you got to get people to come look at it. But.
Well, I mean, I got my syndicated deal before I knew how to draw. Doesn't that happen to everybody?
What? That doesn't even make any sense. The words you just said. So let's back that up again. You said you got your deal with syndication before you learned how to draw.
Here's the loose part story. Let me take a sip here. I at the time, and this is near the turn of the century, I'm marking myself as more decrepit than I appear. I've worked for years at the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Philadelphia Daily News in a variety of capacities. At the time, I also did a lot of funny radio commercials for the newspaper and for a lot of other people. I was writing them for agencies and stuff like that. And I was a stand-up comic. So the editor, the comics editor at the Inquirer, came by and said, you know, would you like to take a look at these comic submissions, you know, because you're a funny guy and, you know, we'd value your opinion. So
I'm tired of looking at all this stuff. So here, take it.
Yeah, I kept saying, you know, some of this is really bad because I was coming at it as a pure of a joke kind of a thing. I didn't get the idea that for many people they're a comfy blanket. You know, people want to see Garfield doing the same stuff. They want to see, Blondie and Dennis the Menace. It took me a long time to accept that there's an aspect of it that is that warmth, that recurring stuff. So, but I didn't see that at the time, and I just kept looking at the stuff they said and said, "This is awful. I could do better than this."
Looking for the funny. I'm looking really hard. Yeah,
you know, that's what I used to say. My goal is to bring funny back to the funny papers. But right. So he said, you know, after a while, he said, "Well, why don't you try it?"
And now, wait. Now, did he say, "Why don't you try it?" Or do you say, "Well, why don't you try it?" What I want to know that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No. Well, he actually just, he retired kind of, and right. He was very involved in syndicates, and the LA Times syndicate was looking for new talent, and they were, the now defunct LA Times syndicate was looking for talent. And Bob called me and said, "You know, you really should try this." And I said, "But Bob, you know, I don't draw," but I had a partner. I still do. We still work together. Named John Gilpin, who was a very fine cartoonist. He had stuff in Penthouse and in Saturday Evening Post. That kind of sort of magazine gag cartoon from time to time. And so John and I said, "Well, oh," he didn't, you know, Bob asked like four or five times, and he finally called and said, "This is serious. You know, you should try." And so John and I got together. I wrote like 30 of them, like 30. Five jokes in a weekend.
Oh wow! Right.
I know it sounds strange, but
no, that sounds amazing.
John took them and he drew them up, and we gave them to Bob. And about two or three weeks later, we get a call from Steve Christensen, who's the VP of something or other at LA Times Syndicate. He says, "I'm on the East Coast. I'd like to see you guys for lunch." And he said, "You know, how'd you like to sign up for a syndicate deal?" I know. I can hear cartoons hitting the floor
right
around the world.
It's like, you know, many times I've submitted and been rejected.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have a theory about that too. Part of it is they need to know that you can have the discipline and that kind of stuff. And I had already worked at newspapers, and I had already been a heavily deadline oriented guy. So I think that was part of it. They knew that they were dealing with somewhat fully formed adults. Right.
They were dealing with someone who was already in there. It's like hiring from within.
Yeah. And so we did this, and John actually drew those parts for the first year. And that was around the time too that the LA Times was doing Dr. Katz, professional therapist for Comedy Central. And so they asked me if I wanted to write for that. I said, "Yeah, that'd be cool."
I love your responses to stuff. Yeah, whatever. I was just going to go home and drink beer anyway.
I just finished reading John Cleese's biography. And there's a lot of that in there too.
There really is. I was talking about John Cleese today. He is just amazing. If you haven't read the biography, do read it, people.
Yeah. And it's just like, you know, things were. So anyways, we do this, and I'm writing 60 jokes a week and working full time, and I got kids, and you know, it was an interesting period of time. And so about a year in 1 week, like within like two or three days, Comedy Central cancels Dr. Katz.
No.
And everything to do with it. and so, you know, I'm SOL there.
Right.
And then John, he gets sick. He got diagnosed with cancer. He's fine.
But
he didn't know at the time. So he says to me, you know, "I don't know. I don't want to really spend weekends doing this." And he says, "So I guess that's the end of the comic." And so I call the syndicate and I say, "Maybe not." And I call them and I say, "You know, John's quitting." And they said, "Yeah, we heard." I said, "Well, do you mind if I draw it as well as write it?" And there was a pause,
good. Well, there should be a healthy pause there. There should be
a pause. Yeah. I can see you rolling your eyes over there in Halifax. And then they said, "Sure, go ahead." And I can remember really, I hung up the phone and I turned to my wife and I say, "My God, what have I done?"
Did you have any faith in yourself that you could draw this no problem? Because I heard you say something earlier that I think is a key to success. So did you think you could draw?
Did I think I could draw?
Yeah.
Put it like this. Oh, there's another interesting story behind this. Remind me of the Dan Collins story. Mark down Dan Collins
story. Dan Collins, all right.
But I had actually, I was a graphic artist, you know, so I knew the process of getting things into print and stuff. So that was helpful.
Right.
But drawing, no. I had taken one brief fling at it like 10 years earlier. When I saw Bleckman,
right,
Bob Bleckman's stuff, and I thought, anybody can do that. you know, because I'm an idiot and filled with hubris. And I tried to do some, and I had sent some to magazines and got, you know, I sent like 10, you know, not even an effort, and got those back. Matter of fact, I had met Bleckman years later, and I had told him that story.
Right.
And he didn't take it as well as I thought he would. But I carry, when I go to these places, I carry a little sketchbook with me, and I ask people to draw on them. And so I have original drawings from all these cartoonists, and his is one of the ones I cherish the most. So anyways, I had this vague idea that I was going to try to write myself around the problem. So basically what I did was just, you know, I had about a 3-month cushion or a couple of month cushion, because those were the ones we had in the can. So I sat down and I just put my butt in the chair, and, you know, it would take hours each day to do a cartoon. And if I couldn't draw it, I would rewrite it into something I could draw. Right. So the very first one ever was salmon at the mall. It was a diagonal line with the top of a salmon going up the down escalator.
Nice. So salmon at the mall. That conjures up images. But you made it fit, right? You were like, okay, I drew this salmon.
Right. And so, you know, here, and then so a lot of my stuff, since I had a background in you know, dialogue and radio commercials and TV commercials, I didn't have to have a lot of motion. I didn't have to have a lot of, you know, action. Like, I could draw someone running at the time. So it was a lot of interesting dialogue. I put glasses on people because I couldn't draw eyes. And people were writing me saying, I love the way everybody has glasses. That way you don't see the reaction. You put themselves in their spot. And, I'm like, no, I can't draw eyes.
When people interpret art, it usually favors the artist, because like, oh my God, you're a genius. You figured out that drawing hands wasn't necessary in comics. You're brilliant.
And to be honest, those first year or so was really, you know, I got them out. And they Mark Tertulli actually was very encouraging through that period of time.
Right. He was really drunk, so he was.
Yeah, right. Yeah, really. What am I doing? But he said, oddly enough, John Gilpenstahl was a very New Yorker style. Like there's a guy named Saxon. I don't know if you remember him.
Yeah.
Who was he just a lot of free flowing lines. And Mark says, but your drawings match your humor, where that was kind of always a disjoint between your kind of a bleakish, farsightish kind of thing and this New Yorker style. But now the match of the styles really helped it. And I think he was lying because he was drunk and short.
Just short. Like,
note that down, Mark.
Very short. I like that. Short equals liar. Terribly
short, man. But you need a place to rest your beer, so it's helpful. So anyways, I got through it, you know, and now, you know, I'm 6,000 in a row. And at a certain point, you know, you get good.
Right. Because
which everybody tells you that's the way, and you don't listen. You know, it worked out great. I'm really happy to do it. One thing that you guys probably experienced at a much younger age than I did was the sheer joy of drawing. Never realized that feeling of, you know, pen on paper or pencil on paper, and just the act of doing it, the physical act of doing it. I didn't realize I was going to enjoy it as much as I did. And I still do. And, you know, I don't know if it's because I started relatively later in life or not. But it's certainly, I never sit down thinking it's drudgery. It's always just fun to draw because it's still new to me. It's not something that I kind of burned out because I was doing it since 5.
Right.
So in a weird way, it happened at a time when I was mature enough and had enough connections and enough chops in all these other creative areas that it made it all kind of come together. It's not the normal route you would think of, and only looking back can you see that. Thank God I was on meth.
you have the X factor, that bit that goes, and I think this is something that anyone who's going to find success, especially earlier in life, is going to go, hey, I can do that. When you have that attitude of, hey, I can do that and even better. I think I've kind of lost that as I've gotten older. When I was young, it was always no one is like, I could do that. That's stupid. As I've gotten older, I'm like, I can't do that. And that is detrimental.
Yeah. I thought, you know, I think as you get older, you realize so many people are faking it, you know, kind of, and I, you know, I might as well fake it too, but people, you know, people seem to like it. And I would go to people, and I'm my own harshest critic, as most of us are.
Right.
But, you know, there was enough people who encouraged me to it. And I was also lucky, like, you know, had I tried a web comic or a graphic comic, you know, they would have justifiably thrown me out my nose. But what I do is a very, you know, it's a writing intensive kind of thing too. That ability, I'm a very fast writer since I've always done it. Right. When I work, it generally takes me about an hour to 90 minutes to write about 10 to 12 gags.
Wow. So I got to ask. Wow. So, you know, most of the podcast interviews we do are with artists. We do writers as well, but I don't think I've ever asked the question when I was drawing at 5 and really just discovering myself. Were you writing at 5? Were you taking little note cards and writing little jokes about grandma? I mean,
well, you know, I was, but I didn't think of it that way. You know, I was always kind of. The first time I really ever, it was high school when I joined the high school newspaper to avoid typing class, which just sounds really odd that you would join the newspaper. And they gave me a column on the back of the page and said, write, do whatever you want. I think I told Tom this story. I just decided to do a humor column and I wrote this, you know, bizarre stuff, you know, fake news stories about, I don't know. I think the first one I wrote was they're changing the picture of George Washington on the U.S. quarter because one makes him look short or something. And I remember sitting in the cafeteria in high school and looking at people reading the paper and laughing. You could see they were reading what I wrote like from across the room.
Right. Except for Billy, and he was looking quite concerned and angry.
Yeah, it's a very powerful feeling. And, you know, I kept doing that, and I got to Penn State, and I was sort of the editor of a magazine called The Froth, which was like the Onion of Penn State.
Right.
And I kept doing it more and more. And then that, you know, as I got into newspapers, I started doing more ad work and comedy and, you know, comedy commercials and funny things like that. And then, you know, I started dabbling in stand up a little bit. And so all that idea of, you know, how to write a joke, timing and meter and how to come up with it and then the stuff for like TV, directing a TV commercial, you're blocking a scene. You know, you're blocking the same way you're blocking that square in the paper,
right?
Of who talks to who and stuff like that. So I was getting these influences without knowing it. What I needed to do was to build the muscle memory and the lines and all that kind of stuff. And you know, that took a little bit longer, but it finally caught up to everything else, I think.
Right. I think that's too. And for those listening, those people have focused on their style of art for the complete piece that is a web comic. You got to loosen up a little bit. And do like the Dave over here and just kind of go, hey, I'm going to write something funny.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I talk at schools or sometimes occasionally they'll say, what's it like? And, you know, and I'll tell them, I say, get yourself a pad of post-it notes. And for the first month, I want you just to take one off. Remember to take one off the pad every day and stick it to the wall. That's all I want you to do. And then the next month, do the same thing, but every one of those has to have a joke on it that you'd be happy that your mother saw and your really clever friends, you know, the ones that rip you to shreds if you did something sappy or bad.
Right.
That's the second month. The third month, you've got to do the same thing, write the joke and draw a picture on every one of those.
Right.
And then you have to repeat that for 10 years.
Wow.
And that's
right.
Pretty much the gig.
And that's all you have to do. Have you had any of those students come back to you and go, I've been doing it?
No.
Not yet.
And you know, and you hate to be like, you know, the dad, although I was often a dad, it's like, you know, so you meet the art kids and the art kids who didn't give a crap about everything else. And I'm like, listen, you're going to need a well to draw on, man. You know, I know you don't like math, but that's like the push-ups. Those are the push-ups you're doing to learn how to make deadlines and turn things in and stuff like that, because you're no good to anybody if you can't hit, you know, the deadline. And so it's you've got to kind of do everything. Like, you know, my cartoon, I've done jokes about philosophy and math and physics and history and geography and, you know, without all that other stuff, you know, you got nothing to draw on anymore.
Right. That's right. Empty. Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's one of the things that a young cartoonist kind of struggles with, is because without having that experience and knowledge of the whole picture, sometimes it's hard to write something maybe to be as flexible as you want to be and writing all kinds of different areas.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't mean to belittle.
I don't think you're belittling, because I was about to flip that on you and go, so, you know, when you're 80 or 90, like next week. Do you think you're going to be,
I'm not over the hill yet.
Is there a point where, you know, you kind of reach that hill and it's no longer as funny anymore? I mean, do you think that kind of happens?
That's interesting.
You're going to get kind of disconnected, kind of like Bill Cosby. And, you know, just because I'm kicking him while he's down. You know what I'm saying? Puddin' Pops, right?
Well, you know, I got to tell you, that is a concern. You know, I try not to be one of these people, you know, like people who listen to only the music they listened to when they were young. You know, people only listen to the stand-ups or the TV commercial. You know, I try to stay abreast of all the stuff that's on. You know, I was watching The Broad Show last night. I found those ladies.
Broad City?
Broad City, yeah. You know, stuff like that. Because, you know, you don't want to kind of lose touch with stuff. And at the same time, I'm dealing in a newspaper world with certain demographics. And I've got to kind of do a little bit of stuff for everybody. So I'm a little conscious of how to do that. Right. The other thing about it is, you know, it's like anything, it's a muscle. You know, I find that if you take a vacation, sometimes it coming back, that 90 minutes stretches into a little longer. You know, the fact is that I swim in doing creative stuff almost every day of my life, and I'm a little scared to stop.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's the success of a lot of creative people. Most prolific writer you're going to find anywhere, Stephen King, he writes at least an hour every day, every day.
Yeah, I tell you. But you know, I'm it's funny now. But like I said, I'm starting to take joy out of the drawing and some pride in the art in my artwork a little more. Which is, I stand in awe of really good artists. You know, like I say, I go to these NCS Reuben Awards weekends every year, and I take this sketchbook and I put it in people's hands, and you know. I remember Sam Viviano, who's the editor of Mad Magazine, the art director of Mad Magazine. I gave it to Sam and I said, "Hey, Sam, would you do me something?" He said, what do you want?" And I said, "I don't know, whatever." And he says, "Stand there." And he holds it up and he does like a portrait of me.
Nice.
Like standing in the hallway.
Right.
And Steven Silver sees it and says, "Oh, I can do that." And he does like this cubist kind of, you know, and before I know it, I've got like, you know, Anton Emden is doing this stuff. Ed Stackley's doing it. And and they're like, "Hey, would you draw something for me?" I go,
you're like, "Stand there for a minute."
Yeah, how about if I draw somebody with glasses? So it's like you're reacting to this.
So you're saying if he goes to like a Reuben meeting, everybody there wants to draw. So they're, right. They're fairly happy with the career they have chosen.
Yeah. That's great. And you can see why, because, you know, let's be honest here, outside of a group of people, it's even being a syndicated cartoonist is still a working man's job. You know, we're not making huge sums of money here.
Right.
You know, but I have other careers and actually I've bled the cartooning in to do some corporate stuff and started animating a little too. And you know that it's people are looking for that. It's funny, the web kind of has it used to be PR agencies and ad agencies would send out letters to people, but now they run people's websites, and nobody wants to read a boring blog from some chemical company or some you know software company. But if you could find someone who had one foot in the marketing world and 1 foot in the bizarre humor world who could do a comic about it, they pay very well for that. And they find their hits go up immensely. Yeah. And quite frankly, I take it as I don't look at it as beneath me. I look on it as a really challenge. And the idea that you can take the most obscure subject you get, give it to me, and I'll bring it on, man. I'll try to find something funny, and I'll try to make your business better, and I'll get some more followers for what I really do.
Right. That's a great mind. And I know that you do a comic with a travel agency, correct?
Yeah. Friendly Planet Travel. This agency had me do it. It's been like 4 years. I've been doing one a week. And you start that and you're like, whoa, how many travel cartoons can you do? And especially then they start giving me topics like Dubai. We would like, cartoons about Dubai.
Right.
And you're like, and they have to be approved by like their travel minister.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I know editors are tough, but these people are trying to sell something. How hard is it to get to those guys?
So I did the Muhammad ones for them.
Oh my gosh. Get out of here.
My wife was like, do not do the Muhammad.
Right. Don't even think about it. Don't even joke.
Yeah. So I think I did NASCAR comes to camel races, like camels with like sponsorship stickers all over them or something like that.
Nice.
So I do this stuff all the time. But Loose Parts is that's the home base. That's my that's the route that all this other stuff is coming off of. And I think I'm getting better. And I like to think every year I grow a little bit more. And I just moved to the Washington Post Syndicate with Amy Lago, who's an amazing editor, and has been wonderful to me. And a couple of months in, that's looking really good. And I love working with those people, and hopefully good things are coming my way.
Right. Right. Okay. So 2015, I'm a cartoonist and I've still got the dream of becoming a syndicated cartoonist. What do I do? How do I approach this?
Yeah. The gateway for a lot of this is the syndicates, but it's amazing. I see people who do it, and I still occasionally see submissions today. They don't seem to pay much to like where the opening might be, where the whole what part of the pages, what audience isn't being served, And you see some of the new ones coming in. This one focuses on a teenager. This one focuses on suburbia. The ones that get in, they have a selling point that goes with it. I've seen people who have lovely strips. They're about an animal in the woods, and you can tell it's their passion. They love this character, and it's well done, and it's well drawn, and it's well conceived. But there's no spot for it. There's no audience for it. There's no reason for it to go in. You have to think like a syndicate will think, like, how do I walk into this editor and sell this cartoon? Right. Now, real talent overcomes that. Stefan Pastis with, I'm coming in with a pig and a mouse and I don't really know what I'm talking about.
Right. Live in suburbia.
Buy my comic. Just the sheer drawing of zits, those guys, and that stuff can work over the top of everything else. But Terry LeBand's Edge City, really smart. A thing about suburbia, that's, you could almost sum it up in time. So that helps. Doing that kind of thing helps. Some track record of consistency and making the deadlines. I'm convinced this really helps. I was shocked that it was many years into my career before I don't like missing deadlines, and I pride myself on never missing one. And I work way ahead. Right now, as I talk to you, my syndicate has all my cartoons finished through the end of March.
Wow.
I have another 30 or so drawn, but not assembled into panels. And beyond that, I have another 20 or so written.
And that's why they love you. They saw that before they even said, hey, we should off this guy a thing. We should offer him a contract. Yeah, they knew that.
And so many other people, I asked once, I said, I'm okay, are you? And they started laughing. They literally said that so many of the cartoonists are a week out. You know,
that is scary, man. Living a week out, that is.
Yeah, just, but just then
today
again,
on Twitter, Bill Amond was saying that he was up until like 3 o'clock in the morning last night to make a deadline.
Oh my gosh.
But see, I don't have this worry about having to draw well.
So you guys have set your standards way too high.
See, I don't. Yeah. He can't draw. So he doesn't have to be held to the high standard of.
Right.
So if you're going, so it's a really crowded field. I just heard of a guy who signed a deal this week, Joe Waz out of Pittsburgh. Wonderful guy. I used to ran the Toonzeum in Pittsburgh. Just signed up with the creators. I'm not sure what he's done, but people are getting signed. Things are coming up. The problem is, I'm just as guilty of it as anyone else. I'm sure when Loose Parts showed up, people said, oh my God, not another Far Side single pen, and I say that, and there's really good people, Tony Carrillo with F minus shows up and I'm like, Jesus, I'm done. And Mark Parisi's doing Off the Market. Dave Coverley's got Speed Bump and there are these Dave Wammen. And if I didn't know these people who are wonderful and have been so wonderful to me, I'd be pissed, but it unfortunately, as I tell people, this I'm not talented enough to do anything other than what I do here. This Loose Parts is sort of an extension of my brain and the way my humor and the way I think. And when I do get like those angry Far Side ripoff letters, right, as we all do, I respond and said, I'm really not talented enough to draw any other way. I'm sorry.
Nice.
If my cow looks like that, but I only know this one way to draw.
I'm sorry. The only book I had on drawing was the Gary Larson Book of Drawing. That's what I learned is what I know. And it really speaks volumes about Gary Larson that he came in, did his thing for 10 years and you can't do a single panel comic strip without being compared to him.
Yeah, it's strange. And thank God, boy, he was an influence on me, but there were people before him.
Oh yeah. There was plenty of people. What about Herman? I left Herman.
Yeah. Herman or B. Kleiman.
Yeah.
And even going back, the George Booth and these guys were great. And, that you can see the influences down the line, but I don't begrudge him. I follow his stuff, but I'm just not talented enough to do anything other than what I do and how I do it.
I think your voice is very unique. I think it's unique enough. It makes me laugh. And so that's what's really important, right?
Thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah. Thank you.
So, all right. So you did this stand-up comedy thing for a while. You thought I was going to just like gloss over it and pretend like you didn't say it, but you did. You did the stand-up comedy stuff, and I am bring that back, because I know on your website I read that you were recently listening to some Mitch Hedberg, who I love. I think he was brilliant, taken way too soon.
Yeah, he's one of those guys. And you ever have this with it's either with a book or a web comic or something that you meet someone that you've fallen in love with and you meet someone who doesn't know it. Like someone says, I've never heard of Mitch Hedberg. And like, I almost envy you.
Then you are in for a treat.
You're in for it. You have this all in front of you to digest. Yeah. It was in the 90s. And, this was comedy was, especially stand-up, we had a real high period at that time.
Yeah, I mean, we was taking everything. We were taking Pauly Shores. We didn't care. What you got?
A Carrot Top.
Right. Yeah. Bring it on.
People were fighting over the center square in a Hollywood Square. And my wife and I would go to comedy clubs in and around Philly. And, much like, the cartoon business, I'd sit there and thinking, This guy's not funny. I could do this. And
there it comes again.
During that period of time, I got a thing in the mail in the Philadelphia area. There's a thing called Main Line School. My, cities have them. They're like annexes, night classes. And in there was stand-up comedy taught by this guy who was a comedy booker. You know, I'd run clubs, and you know, and my wife says, "Well, you know, why don't you try it?" And so I go to this class at a, you know, in a high school,
right?
And the basic point of this thing was, you know, you talked about how to put a set together, and at the end, everybody in the class goes to a bar. You get, you know, goes to a comedy club. You get 5 minutes on stage, and it was a good. You could see the deal. The bar loved it because everybody brought 10 people,
right?
You know, and it makes a lot of sense. So. That's what I did. And you know, I was a strong writer. So the writing the jokes was not there were actually people in there who had to be told that you didn't just stand up there and do somebody else's routine. <You know? laughs> It was just, and the guy said, you know,
so you can't get up for 15 minutes and do Bill Cosby or Richard.
Somebody
Pryor.
Tried to do Rodney Dangerfield's routine verbatim.
Oh my God.
And was stunned when the booker said, you know, you need to write your own jokes.
Right.
So anyways, you know, I did this and he said, you know, you're pretty good. And would you mind, like, do you want to try this for real? And because, you know, this was, I mean, we're talking restaurants or, you know, right. spaghetti restaurants are at 9 o'clock, moving the tables aside, putting a microphone up. And so they needed people to fill shows. And so, you know, when I started out, I only had to do 5 minutes, 10 minutes or so. I can distinctly remember going to one place, the light above me was a food warmer light.
And I'm done. Get it?
I'm underneath, you know, you've made it when you're in, you know,
right. When you're cooking, right.
Food warmer light. Yeah. Right.
So now hold up. So you've said, okay, what some of the similarities are between the stand up and what you're doing now. What are some of the big differences between the stand up and what you do on a comic page?
Well, I'll tell you, the best thing about comedy, well, the worst thing about cartooning is solved by stand-up comedy. The worst thing about cartoon, and it's much better now than when I first started doing it, is the lack of feedback, the lack of instantaneous feedback.
Right.
That if you do a cartoon and unless somebody emails you or now Twitters you or Facebook or lets you know, you have trouble gauging how you're doing. And even the people who will contact you are only the people who like it. Very few people will call you to tell you it was bad. Right. So you have trouble gauging your material. And I'm convinced that before the internet took hold, one of the reasons there was a lot of sort of unfunny things is that the people just didn't know.
Right. The lag was just too large.
They were only exposed to letters or good responses, never some comedy, stand-up comedy, however, is the other end of the spectrum. So right.
You got your whole boo and everything. Right,
or silence, which in many ways is worse than a boo, right. Because boo, at least you've elicited some sort of reaction from the zombies, right. Where... silent, and I'm well acquainted with that, was what I kind of loved about it. And I missed when I started doing cartooning. So there was that instantaneous feedback, but I'm on the right track. This was funny. Right. So that was a big, big difference. I thought with my over prideful self of starting cartooning that I could write my way around this, that if I just, the joke was funny enough, it didn't matter how I told it. And to some degree that was true, but there was so much more to it that I didn't know. And it was fun learning that. It was fun going through the process. I tell the story before that my best example was I used to do a joke. At the time there was in the news, somebody had written a suicide book and literally to help put sick people to put them to suicide. It was all the news. Oh, and so the joke I did on stage was, how about this suicide manual? Boy, here's a book that's overdue at a lot of libraries. right. And it wasn't getting a laugh. And this actually, the guy who booked me, who taught that class, said, you know, they're drunk. It's late. You're going too fast. And that's a hand grenade of a joke where it rolls and it takes 3 or 4 seconds till they can kind of figure it out. So next time you tell it, go over to the stool and take a drink of water.
Nice.
And that's all it took. And so there was this timing kind of aspect to it that became increasingly more interesting in how to tell that joke and find that meter and that rhythm and that timing. I did it for like 3 or 4 years. I never really left the Philadelphia area much. My daughters were fairly young at the time. And he started asking me if I wanted to like go down to Baltimore, Washington, or up to you know, towards New York. And I had a real sort of Waterloo moment that this was a Friday and a Saturday night thing. And it just wasn't fair to my kids. And so I kind of walked away from it. And I miss it. And if it was available now to the degree it was then, I would love to go back and give it a shot.
Hey, comedy clubs have been making a pretty good comeback. There's nothing like it was during the 90s.
Yeah, that was easy. Now you do have to go and do some open mic nights and earn your chops. And, in my spare 20 minutes a day,
man. You sound super busy all the time. So I know you live near a national park. Do you take time to just chill out from all this stuff?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I ran lunchtime today. Ran 4 miles at lunchtime. And
running 4 miles, that is a great way to relax.
Yeah, and my wife and I do like hiking and stuff. We hiked in the Alps. That was great. And before you guys got on the line here, I was playing the guitar a little bit and just kind of chilling out a little bit. Although when I'm done with you, I'm finishing up an animated thing for a client, and I may go, play with that for a little bit while the Flyers game is on.
Do you ever have a time where, okay, I got to ask a question, a little psychological question. Do you have a problem with quiet and silence? I mean, because it sounds like you've got to keep going.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I commute from here into Philadelphia every day. So right. I have a train ride every day of pure silence in an invention called the quiet ride car, where no one's allowed to talk.
Oh, wow.
Cell phone calls, everything. So I have a self-imposed quarantine time every day that I can open a book up and just be with my thoughts. And of course, when you run and exercise and stuff, you're kind of with your, in your own head.
Helps
at that time too. So I do have some quiet times. What I don't do is don't surf a lot, in the web aimlessly. I don't, watch a lot of stupid television. I try to fit everything in that way.
Right, right. So does stupid television rot your brain, like my mom said? Is that true?
yeah, but my mom's brain is rotten. So,
so that was probably the TV talking.
I discounted everything she said. It was all that I Love Lucy coming out.
Well, I Love Lucy. Joel, I just got to ask real quick before we go any further. I got to make sure Joel hasn't bled out over there from his film cut. Oh.
No, I'm still here, but listening to Dave talk about just how he's going about his creative day has me wondering, like, do you have a set routine that you follow? Like, do you get, obviously you've got your day job, but like when you come home in the evenings, like, do you only do, loose parts like 4 nights a week or 5 nights a week, or is it like 7 nights a week? Like, is it something that you're able to manage because you're working so far ahead?
This is a good question. I have a routine. I find the most cartoonists do. You really should talk to Mark Tertulli when he talks about his routine. Man, it makes your head swim with his two cartoons. But right. I
super smart guy, by the way. We've made fun of him, but he's
super smart. And he's been a good friend, and he's helped me a lot. Here's the way it goes. I come home generally in my head. My week starts Monday night at 6 o'clock. I come home. I get home around 6 o'clock on Monday night. I say hello to my lovely wife because she's usually getting home from the office about that same time, and we chat for a little bit. And then by 6:30, I'm in my bedroom with my cat and a beer, and I have a leather bound book, blank pages, and I lie down almost always at 6:30 on Monday nights. And I put some music on, and I stare at the ceiling, and I think. And I think people somehow think that a lot of creativity just comes to you like a gift. And it's funny. This is a trick. I almost hesitate to say it because I feel like I'm giving away a secret that's going to have everybody doing this. I when people say, I can't write a joke. And I say, have you tried? And they say, yeah. And I say, how long do you try? And I says, well, and somebody will think for a minute. And I say, no, you have to think for 15 minutes. 15 minutes. You have to stare at the ceiling for 15 minutes and really work to get it. And I bet you could do it. And nobody ever tries it. It's like only 15 stinking minutes and nobody tries it because it's a long 15 minutes.
That is a long 15 minutes to be alone with your thoughts. People don't like to be alone with their thoughts.
Yeah. So I do that and I've gotten better. So I usually can get into that zone really fast. I from the time I lay down, 3 minutes in, I'm in that zone. And I think you guys are creative guys. Mm. You know what I'm talking about. Okay. You're in that zone. You're just purely thinking about what you do. So I'll stay in that room. I won't leave that room until I've written 10 jokes.
Has it ever backfired like about 3 a.m. going just one more joke?
No, I tell you, it's rare. It happens a handful of times a year that I get really stuck. But I try to push through. So that's Monday night. Right. And then, I don't do anything usually Tuesday or Wednesday, or I'll do freelance work. I'll do some other cartoons or little animated things I'm working on for people or stuff. And Thursday night, I generally try to sit down and knock loose parts out. I work on a Cintiq now. I used to draw my sheer hubris. I used to just draw with pencil on 9x12 paper and ink in with Pigma Microns, and then I'd scan it in the Photoshop and I'd do all the finishing work over there. But a couple years ago, after listening to Terry Levinson, who does Pajama Diaries, talk almost in a sexual context about her Cintiq, I flipped to it, and it sped my process up and helped me immensely. So I'll knock a cartoon out, and when I say knock it out, I generally have just done the drawing and colorized the whole thing, and then I put those all in a file. And so I start that Thursday night. I might do another one on Friday night. So then Saturday morning, I do the bulk of my drawing. I get up and I go right to work around 9 o'clock, and I draw from like 9 to 1 or 2, and I'll finish up at least the 7 for that week. And then on Sunday, I take the ones that are set for Sundays and I do the separation work. I do the black plate, the color plates, and do all that. And if I'm going away on vacation or something, I anticipate that. And I figure out how many weeks I have to work ahead and how many extra ones I have to do. And then I'll add 1 or 2, I'll do 8 a week instead of 7 or 9 a week. And until I've built up a sufficient thing that I can go away. The other good thing is I've been at this newspaper for so long that I've acquired a large amount of vacation time. So I have 6 to 8 weeks of vacation time during the course of the year that I ever get really slammed. Mm-hmm. I can always grab a day here or there and push project out or push something out. So that's generally, it's almost always the routine. I used to do it where, I'd walk around and wait for ideas to come for me. But to some degree, your brain was on all the time and I was getting real tired. And it's much better to do it with intent now.
This is a totally different technique than a lot of people do. A lot of people have the ideas, they wait for the ideas to come. And they usually come in large chunks. But it's usually unintentional.
Yeah, is that how it is for you guys? I mean, I'm always curious about the way other people work too.
Right. Most of my writing is done in the shower, and it's just like I have a moment just to chill out. And almost everything I write is character driven, so I just step into the characters.
Interesting.
In their lives, and I'm like, what would my character be doing right now?
Yeah.
In life, and then the jokes kind of come from there.
Yeah, I remember the difference between doing Dr. Katz as this comic strip was like two different things, like because you had this set of characters and stuff spread from them rather than I start with a fresh slate every kind of cartoon, which is a blessing and a curse. I have a wide field of room in, but it's a curse that I don't have that anchor character to come off of all the time.
So. Right. Joel, how do you do that?
For me, it's the same character-driven stuff, just because the characters in Starcrossed have been around for 5 years now in my head. And potentially longer, too, because I obviously developed the strip before I started publishing it. Yeah. And for me, it's very much a sitcom. So I'll think about something funny or something that's current, like beards. And I'm just like, all right, well, what would Charlie grow a beard? Would he like beards? Would he not like beards? Eventually you kind of get, you get a joke out of it. But something that I know that I do is... It's not as a dedicated evening, but I tend to have ideas come to me as I'm people watching in a cafe or on the bus or something annoying. And I write it down. I email it to myself. I make a note, and eventually it goes into a thumbnail in my sketchbook. Then I get all these thumbnails accumulated. And then when it comes time for me to do a strip, because I only do them about once a week, if I'm on top of things, I know. Right.
Once a week.
Yeah. So then I have this tome of thumbnails, and I can go in, and I'm not slammed into doing a newspaper deadline. So I can go into the thumbnails, and as long as it's not something timely, like a Christmas joke or a summer joke, I can kind of draw what I'm in the mood for. So if I'm in the mood to do something really fun and elaborate, I'll do the characters are dressed up as superheroes and I'm going to do something really fun. Or if it's just I'm really kind of pressed for time, I want to do something very dialogue heavy, I'm in the mood to say something, then I'll grab one of the strips that I've got thumbnailed that is that kind of suits that
so
feeling.
Does it almost come out organically as you draw it? It just reveals itself?
I tend to write, I'll have the dialogue written down. And then the thumbnail kind of comes out as who says what when and what situation they have to be in. So is it going to be, are they going to be dealing at home? Is there a joke where the character has to open the fridge, or is it going to be something that they can be at a pub and they can be sipping beer? And I try to make the characters relatable. So when they talk back and forth, I tend to have them do stuff in the panels rather than just kind of be talking heads, like someone sips coffee or, if someone at the end of the strip has to do a spit take, then that panel before that, they have to be sipping the coffee first, stuff like that. That's the animator in me. That's just the consistency has to be there.
Right.
Oh my God. You know, it's funny watching the way everybody works. I remember one time going to a seminar, at the National Cartoonist Society Reuben Weekend. There's a guy named Jerry Van Amerogen who does a panel called Ballard Street, and he's a wonderful guy. And he just draws as funny. I always say he and Glenn McCoy just draw as funny as I've ever seen, just their art. But he showed how he came up with ideas, and he was standing up, he had an overhead projector, and he says, "Sometimes I do this," and he just literally starts moving his hand on the page with a pen and making swirls, and it's just starting to fill up with all these swirls. And he says, and in here, I can kind of see a nose. And now I see this guy, he's sort of dancing with his wife, and it just emerges from the paper.
He's kind of like a Ouija artist.
That's a great way to put it. It was, I stood there astounded this business is just, you meet the most amazing people and admirable people and just watching the way they work and how they do this stuff. I'm like an old little kid, it's just, it's just really cool. And I'm happy that some of them at least know my name or don't run the other way when I come. And
oh my God, here he comes.
Yeah. And here's that guy. But man, it's been great. It's been nice to meet a lot of these people and talk to them and see how they work. And I'm excited to dig deeper into your guys' stuff too and see what you're doing. And you're probably going to hear from me again saying, how did you do that? Or what were you thinking? And that's pretty cool.
Nice. Dave, you are an amazing writer. And you don't give yourself enough credit for your art, because it is wonderful and charming for someone who waited till later in life to decide to tackle that part. It is, you have this attitude.
What's next? I think improv comedy is next on the list.
You totally got to get back to some improv comedy, because that's got to be the most exhilarating thing you can do.
Yeah.
Because you're either going to make it or you're going to die.
I'll do it when I retire. I'll be the old guy. I'll always be playing the druggist. who's going to do the father in this scene? Dave?
Dave, come over here, sir.
That's right. Yeah.
So. Some of my favorite ones are like older, like Lewis Black. Man, he kills me. And I didn't see him until he was older. I don't know if he did comedy all of his life, but his curmudgeonness.
He does it well. His outrage is really good. So
genuine.
Yeah.
Dave, that's about all the time we have for our show today. We have had a blast.
Hey, just let me do a little plug though. My latest book is out, Odd Fish Sandwich. And you can get it at loosepartscomic.com, my site. You can buy it right from there and see some stuff. I just had it redesigned and bringing it up. So it should work.
That's great. Yeah, I saw your new site. It relaunched in like in December, sometime like that.
Yeah. Except, I had the nightmare of all nightmares. Someone poured a drink down my computer over the holidays and trashed everything. And I've had to rebuild my whole life and world.
That is awful. We should have talked about that some more. Now we have a follow-up show.
Oh gosh.
So you can come in. So it wasn't anything like the Coca-Cola Super Bowl ad where they spilt the Coke into the mainframe.
Yeah.
And just happy things happen?
Well, yeah. You know, we haven't even talked about animation. I wanted to talk to you about that. A couple of years ago, I got into After Effects. And, I've been doing this for a couple of years. It's been to try to bring these things alive. And that's been another interesting, great career. Beat selling insurance.
I'm going to agree with that one, Dave.
Yeah.
Insurance, bad. Drawing, good. Dave, thank you so much. For those who are listening, go to loosepartscomic.com. Check out Dave's great work. Also, grab the book. I'm going to grab mine tonight. By the way, I also got in my, I got a book from somebody we interviewed recently. I'm going to talk about that later after the show. I just want to thank Dave so much for being on the show, man.
Hey guys, thanks. Hope I didn't talk too much.
You didn't talk too much. You talked just the right amount. You know what? Because you can do that. And that's your motto. I can do that. And also,
it's better than not talking enough.
Right?
Yeah, you, man, that your voice sounds like it's on its last legs, man. Yeah,
I know.
Poor old Matt.
I debated not coming on the show.
Well, I'll come back and do episode 400 and maybe Matt can talk that time.
You think, Skippy? Also, visit Matthew Ducharme at, you can visit him on mattthewad.com. You can follow him on Twitter at @_. Well, that's not right. Nope. What is it?
Matt_the_wad.
I just wanted to hear you say it. Also, follow Joel Duggan on Twitter at Joel Duggan, right?
That's me, correct?
Where can they visit your website at?
It's starcrossedonline.com, and I just posted a new comic on Sunday night.
Excellent. Visit everything. Yeah,
and everybody else should, follow me on Facebook, too. My Facebook page is not, I don't talk about, my stuff around the house. I run catching contests and put stuff up there and show sketchbook stuff and do all that, too. So you guys just come along as any listeners. Love to have you. I do a lot of stuff on Facebook almost every day.
Excellent. Also, jumping around, I followed you. Loose Parts Guy. Isn't that your Twitter account?
Yeah. Loose Parts Guy. Right. Yeah.
Follow that as well. You can see everything we do at comicscoasttocoast.com. We have Twitter. We have Facebook. We have all that good stuff. I had a great time. We'll see you guys next week.
Try not to laugh.